Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Eric Alterman. We talked to him, I think, for his last book, for What Liberal Media, which was his best-selling book. He's a distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College and at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Of course, he writes for The Nation, Moment, The Daily Beast. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and at the Nation Institute. His latest book is Kabuki Democracy, The System versus Barack Obama. And Eric, good to talk to you once again. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So if there was a subtext, which is actually the subtitle of your book, for this book, it seems to me it's that, as you write, despite what the right calls Barack Obama a socialist, despite the left saying that he's sold out the Wall Street, and no matter where he started, what happened with healthcare, where he started with every issue, that the system itself is rigged against him, but more importantly, is rigged, from your perspective, against progressive change in America.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. As I say somewhere in the book, if you want to raise, if you want to lower taxes on the wealthy, the system works really well. If you want to start a war based on false information, the system works pretty well. But if you want to address any kind of the fundamental problems that the country's ignored for the past 8 years, in terms of equity or making the government more effective for people in terms of giving them health care, protecting the environment, protecting them from predatory corporations and so forth, the system is rigged. And it's, I mean, one doesn't need to have to agree with everything Obama has said and done or even ignore some very forceful criticism of him that I've made and others have made to say that the results of the system wouldn't have been very different. We might have had a better conversation about things. Things might have been a little clearer. Maybe the Democrats would have done better in the 2010 election, but I don't think the system would have produced any kind of different result because, as I say, the system is rigged.
One of the things you wrote about in the first quarter of the book was people often compare Barack Obama with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And one of the really, I think, really important points you make in those few paragraphs about that is that that Roosevelt was being pushed by the left, while Obama is pushed by an organized right, and Roosevelt had this huge majority that Obama did not have in the beginning of his administration. Those are two kind of points we don't talk about a great deal.
Yeah, and the second part is almost as important as the first part. They had very different kinds of majorities in Congress. It's kind of an illusion to say that Obama had super majorities in both houses because the Democratic Party is a very divided party, unlike the Republican Party, which is a united ideological party and a coherent ideological party. And presidents, unlike Roosevelt's time, they don't have the influence that they had that presidents used to have over local elections because candidates raise their own money and they raise from corporations. So the candidates, the senators and the congressmen who are resisting Obama's agenda in purple states and states that are usually red states are beholden to their lobbyists and to the people who buy their campaigns much more than they're beholden to their own parties, to their own president. There isn't really much Obama can do about that. A lot of people on the left and in the Nation, where I write a column, complain that Obama should go into these districts and campaign against these people. Well, that wouldn't help. That would probably hurt. So he really had no choice. Once he made a decision, and he made this decision on day one, that what he wanted to do was pass the best legislation he could, be as effective as possible, rather than shake up the system, he had no choice but to negotiate every little fine point with every little complainer, and that took a real toll on the quality of the legislation. It ended up killing cap and trade, and it ended up weakening both the financial regulation bill and the health care reform bill to the point where they could have been written by moderate Republicans, if there were such a thing.
If there were such a thing. Let me ask this one question. I'm curious why you think that the Republicans are a much more coherent ideological party. You write in here about a little piece about how when Abercrombie was a congressman from Hawaii and then decided to leave, he left before the vote on health care. The same thing happened with a Republican congressman whose name I'm blocking on, but who was going to resign as well from Mississippi, I believe, and the Republicans weighed in on him and sat on him until he agreed to stay until after that vote.
Right, and Abercrombie, the Democrats threw a party for him, and he didn't even show because he'd already left. It's like a perfect metaphor.
So it is, but why? Why is that, do you think?
Well, a couple reasons. One is that the Republicans have a genuine popular movement inside their party, and that party and that movement punishes Republicans who don't adhere to its views. So they run candidates against them in primaries, and they're willing to lose. The Republicans would be controlling the Senate today if it weren't for the Tea Party, because the Tea Party forced them to run untenable candidates in places that they could have won. So they're willing to pay the price for their ideological cohesion. Second is that at the beginning, because they got so whooped in 2006 and 2008, and they were down to 40 members, the leadership of the Republican Party, particularly in the Senate, turned to their fellow senators and said, look, the only thing, the only power we're going to have in this place is to block things, because we can stop we can threaten filibuster. So if you want to have any influence over on anything, we all have to stand together on everything. And they were willing to do it. The fact that they have this conservative anti-government ideology makes them very comfortable playing strictly obstructionist politics, whereas Democrats can't do that. Democrats need to make the system work regardless of what it's working for. That's the ideology of the insider Washington, and that's the ideology of Democrats who've been in power for any length of time. So the two parties operate very differently. And again, it also reflects the fact that Democrats do have centrist and conservative members, and Republicans have no liberal members and very, very few centrist members left. So it's really the two parties are not really comparable. I mean, if you just take a look at Fox News and the kind of lying and ideological fixation and obsession that it demonstrates, and MSNBC, which has a liberal tilt, but basically tells both sides and tries to stick to the facts, and in the morning has 2 hours every day of a conservative broadcast, you can see how the two different views are reflected by their cultures.
When you said culture, made me think of that part in one of the chapters of the book, The Power of Culture. And where you talk about the differences between Democrats and Republicans in the last few minutes, but the power of culture you write about is the power of corporate culture, with its tentacles surrounding everybody, Democrat and Republican, inside the House and Senate. So,
That's the power of one particular culture. There are a lot of cultural factors involved, and you know, one of them is sort of the permanent government of Washington. But in terms of you're talking about, it's the power of the culture of finance. I'm a big fan of the Italian communist philosopher. I'm not a fan of too many communists, but this one I am, Antonio Gramsci.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Who wrote these prison notebooks that are very hard to read, but other people read them and explained what they said. And he talks about how ruling elites create ideologies that masses buy into so that they don't have to rule by force. And in the case of our country, the ruling elite of Wall Street, the really, really rich people, have created this ideology that the rest of the country has by and large bought into, that the system works best when government stays out of the market and rich people are unencumbered to make as much money as they possibly can, and the government only steps in when the system is actually teetering on the brink of collapse. And the result is that they are allowed to behave incredibly irresponsibly, that there is an enormous gap in rich and poor, nothing like any other Western democracy, and the rich are able to buy their what they want from the political system by virtue of our allowing money to play such a large role. You can't ever get money out of politics entirely, but no other country finances their elections the way we do, and nobody thinks twice about this. And the way this manifests itself in legislation is not only that that the people who are running for office have to do what the people who are paying their campaign for their campaigns want them to do, but the staffers who work for the people writing the bills are all planning to go to work for the people that they're regulating. In the case of the financial regulation bill, the head of the House Banking Committee staff, who was working for Barney Frank, right, switched sides to Goldman Sachs in the middle of the negotiations, as if he weren't being paid a bribe to have done his job for the other side. It's like he was a Soviet spy and switched sides, and yet there's no shame in it. So it's really shocking, the power of culture, that nobody pays attention to it. It's just considered business as usual. This guy was he was rather impatient. But almost everybody, in fact, just about everybody who was on, who works for one of these finance committees, either banking or Senate Finance, et cetera, goes to work for the big banks or has already worked for the big banks. Goes back, they go back and forth. None of them work for Acorn or Common Cause. They all work for Goldman Sachs and Warburg and Citigroup and so forth. So it's a very difficult thing to break this power, this the power of this culture.
So let's talk about some of the ideas you've talked about in terms of that, though. I mean, if you when you write about public financing of elections and voluntary public funding and issues like that, I at the end of reading all that, I was still left with a question. But how can it work? I mean, if we move towards, let's say, if the battle has always been, there's always been this battle for public financing of elections that has gone down in flames because the Supreme Court overturned something in the fine called McCain bill or you know, people who publicly finance elections don't have enough money to win, so they have to go and start getting money from corporations. Barack Obama talked about he was going to take public financing, then dropped it when he saw he needed more money. I mean, how do we get?
Well, with regard to the Supreme Court, we're talking about two different issues and combining.
Okay, go ahead.
There is the biggest single problem we have is the Supreme Court, and it's their two-pronged view that that money equals speech and that corporations equal people. And as long as money equals speech and corporations equal people, then it's almost impossible to control corporate spending. And that's a terrible, terrible problem. And I think it's wrong. The Constitution doesn't ever say either of those two things. And the interpretation that it's based on is very iffy. It's like an aside that one justice made like 100 years ago. And if Barack Obama set it in his mind to make that a litmus test for Supreme Court justice nominees, that would be a great thing. That would get us on the road to overturning that. But that's a long way off. If you can't do that, and for the time being you can't, if you can't control corporate spending, then what you can do is try to equalize the two sides with public financing of campaigns. We have had that for presidential elections until recently, when in fact it was Barack Obama who decided not to do it. Because he had such an advantage over John McCain, and the amount of money we give to the candidates has not kept up with the cost of the elections, in part because television time is so expensive. Television time, by the way, was the only thing that was not included in the McCain finance bill. But we've never had congressional elections, and congressional elections are the real problem because that's where the legislation gets written. I mean, right now, as we're speaking about this, the details on the finance reg bill are still being written because, you know, there's like 1,200 separate rules that have to be issued on the basis of the legislation. And nobody's paying attention except for the lobbyists. The press has completely forgotten about it. And public interest lobbyists, you know, they don't have anything like the staff to push back against the corporate lobbyists. So we're getting screwed in ways that we won't find out about for 10 years. All those laws that we found out about, all the deregulation stuff that we didn't find out till we needed it, when the banks were going crazy with, you know, the mortgage financing and so forth, those were all written while no one was paying attention. And the same thing's happening. So we'll find out about it in the next crisis, when it's going to cost us another $1 trillion to bail out the banks.
So I wonder why you think that there can't be a Tea Party of the left or of liberals. I mean, I got an email this morning from David Corton. A story out of England where there's this movement that they're not covering very much in America, but has gotten thousands of people in the street to protest wealthy tax cheats. It's kind of bubbled up from the bottom. At the same time, Cairo is bubbling up. This is bubbling up in England. And so, something is stopping us at this point. I'm going back to the first part of your book where you talked about how Roosevelt was pushed from the left and Obama's being pushed from the right. There seems to be a real difficulty.
Yeah, I don't think there can't be a Tea Party from the left. I just think it's a lot harder. In part because the Tea Party is really just a front for big money.
Right.
I mean,
right.
The Tea Party is arguing against their own interests. So if you take a look at the people who actually make up the Tea Party, they're arguing on behalf of the interests of the extremely wealthy and of the corporate elite. So if we were arguing on behalf of the interests of the wealthy and the corporate elite, we'd have a lot of money to organize our demonstrations and our conferences and to pay, you know, $100,000 speaking fees to people like Sarah Palin if we had those kinds of people as well. So in some sense, the Tea Party is a mirage. Look, only about 20% of the country agrees with the Tea Party. Their leaders are idiots. I mean, have you listened to Michelle Bachmann?
Yes,
she's an nincompoop. She thinks that the United States Constitution, as written in 1789, outlawed slavery. She's never heard of the Civil War. And that's who they picked. And that's who CNN agreed to
cover.
Treat as if she were the alternative president.
Right.
It's madness. So I don't take the Tea Party all that seriously. The thing that's most interesting about the Tea Party is why the media take them so seriously. And that has a lot to do with the power of Fox News and the unwillingness of the rest of the media to treat Fox News as the pariah that it deserves to be in the news business. But a Tea Party of the left, I don't know. The last time we had a movement like that was during the 1960s, and it didn't end very well. The anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, they did a lot of good early on, but as things got, and I don't really have a good explanation for exactly why this happened, but as time went on, and American people got sort of tired of the issue, both movements got angrier and angrier and began to distance themselves from the values of quote-unquote middle America. They started out speaking to these values very effectively and then ended up condemning them, so that the anti-war movement and the Black Power movement became sort of anti-American movements by the 1970s and tore the Democratic Party apart and alienated the white working class. And some of that was inevitable, but not all of it. And so, I'd be all in favor of a strong grassroots movement to support liberalism and progressivism in this country, but I don't even see the building blocks of it right now. I don't see where it's going to come from. I mean, I like a lot of people, I was very optimistic about the fact that the Obama campaign collected 13 million email addresses, and if you just took say 5 or 10% of those people, you'd have a movement. People who are really dedicated, 1 out of 20 or 1 out of 10, you'd have a movement of somewhere between 700,000 and 1.3 million people who wanted to continue the fight for progressive priorities. But the Obama campaign just let those people just sort of lie there. Every once in a while, they'll send out an email saying, "Hey, aren't we great?" Or "Hey,
right.
Call your congressman." But they weren't interested in a bottoms up movement like the Tea Party, because then those people start running candidates against their candidates, and they want to run everything themselves. So I think right now, as long as there's a Democratic president, and a Democratic president is quite popular among liberals, by the way, there isn't going to be a Tea Party. There's going to have to be, we're going to have to, I think right now we should focus our attention on fighting the power of corporations to pervert our politics and some of these other issues, rather than taking on the president. The president should be pushed, but I don't think he can be sort of the focus of our anger, because, and there's a famous story. I'm not sure it's true, actually. I know someone has looked into it, where Roosevelt says to his liberal critics, "I agree with everything you said. Now go make me do it."
Right. It was supposed to be done with A. Philip Randolph.
Right. I don't think it actually happened, but it's a very effective metaphor for what the left needs to do with Barack Obama. They need to make him do stuff, because he actually, I think, wants to do the good stuff. It's just that he's willing to take any deal that's on the table. He's not willing to hold out, in the hopes of something better. So a better deal has to be created.
Let me pick up on just a few more thoughts that from what you've just been saying. I mean, one of the things you talk about it in the book, and as you've done subsequently in the articles in The Nation and other places as well, is the arcane nature of the rules of the House and the Senate. Holds,
yeah.
Filibusters that you write about in some detail. And you then talk about how it's really difficult to get media and public attention for this kind of process, because it's just so complex and arcane that people don't put their hands around it. They don't want to deal with it because, it's just too much. But
yeah.
it is the heart of what stops legislation that can be progressive from going through.
Well, the thing is we have a system.
Though.
Yeah, we have a system that's set up to enable obstruction. And as I said earlier, Republicans are much more comfortable with obstruction than Democrats. So they use it much more frequently. There have been way more cloture votes on filibuster-type issues in the past 2 years than they were ever before, and in the past 4 years since the Democrats took over. So that's a real net disadvantage for the Democrats. The Democrats are just not comfortable being confrontational, and Republicans love it. I mean, when you have the leader of the Republicans in the Senate saying our main priority is to defeat Barack Obama, it's not to better the country. It's not to make government work effectively. It's to defeat Barack Obama. No Democrat would ever say such a thing. And they wouldn't even say it in private. I mean, a few Democrats would say it in private, but not the leadership. That's not who they elected as their leader. So it's really two different cultures. And people don't treat it that way, in part because they don't understand it, in part because it's so arcane, and in part because conservatives have such an enormous advantage in the media that the story doesn't get told.
It doesn't get told, and I mean, I think it was Harkinsville you were talking about who was trying to change the filibuster rule.
Yeah. Well, the other problem, the other reason the filibuster rule doesn't get changed is that it gets to the individual power of the senators, because if you just get a bunch of people, enough people on your side, even if they only represent a small percentage of the country's population, you can get what you want. And so it's in the individual senator's interest to keep these very arcane rules because it makes them more powerful, although it's not in the country's interest, and certainly not in the interest of, you know, of democracy per se.
There's probably the more powerful example in your book than when you write about the power of right-wing media and how it manipulated, was part of manipulating the entire global warming our debate in this country, where people began to think, as you quote this electrician who said that it's a lie and that even the Bible said so, and you describe how this kind of whole argument was made by the right to kind of to manipulate public thinking in America, paid for by corporations, and it's just like this camouflage beast that takes over the minds of the
well,
country.
Well, it's a really shocking and shameful thing about our country that the number of people who believe in the reality of man-made global warming has declined in the past 2 years, when in fact the evidence has gotten stronger. Our media have made us dumber. We know less than we did 2 years ago. We would think more people knew the truth 2 years ago than know it today, and that number is declining. Of the 20 Republicans up for Senate seats in 2010, 19 of them said that man-made global warming was a hoax. And it's ridiculous. There isn't any respectable scientific body that agrees with that. And they've all, the argument is over. And yet that issue is now, in our politics, that's a minority issue. The truth is a minority issue. You have to be brave to say what I just said if you're a politician.
Right.
It's incredibly shocking. And that is a direct result of an enormous amount of money invested by people who get rich destroying our environment. The most obvious example and the most important example are the Koch brothers, who make their money in the extraction industries, like the same way Dick Cheney got rich, and fund organizations like the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute, all these little organizations that are phony populist Tea Party type organizations that fight this fight on behalf of the corporations while pretending to be on the side of the people. And it's a kind of virtuous circle from their standpoint, because more and more people, like this fellow you're quoting, it's just everyday religious guy, end up believing that this is actually their fight, that it is just a liberal plot to control the temperatures of their house, because that's what we love liberals like to do.
So, given that, I mean, what creates the other argument? I mean, when you look at what happened with this Huffington Post buyout being sold to AOL, and as part mm-hmm. of your world of looking at the media and Nation, other places, is this the building block for a progressive media coming up, or is this just another corporate deal?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. I like Ariana Huffington. She's a friend of mine, she's very smart. And I think her conversion to progressive politics is genuine and is not going to be reversed. But she's also a businesswoman, and she hasn't had to choose between those two things. AOL does not appear to be saying that they're going to handcuff her, and they have a formula for success that definitely leans leftward while it's open to the right. They say it's beyond left and right, and in some cases that might be true, but I think that's kind of a gimmick. So you know, we'll see. But I think it does have the possibility to create the kind of liberal media establishment, you know, with staying power and real money behind it and a sales force and a business plan that we've so far lacked. And in the same way, MSNBC has done that at a smaller scale. So I think it's a good thing, but I could be wrong because it's too early to tell.
As you say, time we'll see with them time how this pans out. But
I wrote a long article about Huffington Post in the New Yorker 2 years ago.
That's right.
And I predicted that it was the newspaper of the future. And I wasn't sure if that was entirely a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it's turning out to be true that there's a lot of crap up there. It's hard to find the good stuff, actually, would be my criticism of it.
Right.
But it is open to all different kinds of views. Conservatives do have a voice there. There isn't any censorship. It's just a much wider canvas than most other publications, and I think that's a pretty good thing.
Right. I mean, it also brings people into it, too. We see all the entertainment news, all the gossip from Hollywood and beyond.
Nipple flips. They're very big on Hollywood.
Right. So a couple of quick things here. When you talked about Barack Obama being a member of the system and where you think he really is as somebody who is, wants things done but will never turn down a compromise when he's faced with it, the 2012 elections come up. And there are a lot of people, especially on the white progressive side of politics in America, who want to take Barack Obama on. And that's really in some ways going to fly in the face of most of the communities of color and progressives within those communities who will support Barack Obama because of A, what he symbolizes, and also that we have to get something done, and this is the wrong time to do that. I can see a pretty dangerous split happening inside the liberal progressive left world over this next election.
I got to tell you, I think the number of those people is really small, and I hope it's politically impotent. The only presidents who lose re-election fights, except in times of recessions, are presidents who are challenged within their party. I don't imagine there'll be any significant Democrat who will want to challenge Barack Obama. So it'll have to be like the one that people keep talking about is Russ Feingold, and he says no way.
He said no way, right?
Yeah. So it would have to be just an independent candidacy on the order of Ralph Nader. And we see how well that worked out. You know, I think Ralph Nader is the single most responsible individual for George Bush's election.
Do you really?
I do. Yeah, I take a lot of flack for that. But my argument would be is there was only one man the day before the election day, the night of election day, who could have prevented that election by going on television and saying, "Look, we ran a great campaign, we raised a lot of great issues. We'll be back in 4 years, but this man is just too dangerous to let near the presidency, and so I'm releasing all of my voters." To vote for Al Gore.
Right.
As unhappy as I am with Al Gore, he's a lot better than George Bush. Could have said that, wouldn't have lost any credibility, would have been a hero. Instead, he played the spoiler, and we got an Iraq war and 8 years of misery. So I think most people learned their lesson. Nader was not a serious candidate in 2004 after people learned their lesson, and I don't think there's a serious, significant chance of that in 2012. I understand people's frustration. I share some of it. But the problem is that they're going after the symbol of the of the problem instead of the problem itself.
Leave us a little bit of thought about how you conclude your book and where you think we can go. I mean, because
I really think the focus has to be on money. The power of money is so significant. It affects everything. And it's not that difficult a story to tell. So I think every progressive group and every liberal, when they talk about their issue, they have to talk about the power of money. Environmentalists have to talk about the power of money. Healthcare people have to talk about the power of money. Immigration people have to talk about the power of money. Absolutely everything turns on money. And we need to reduce that power. Media activists have to talk about the power of money. I think it has to be, you know, there's just not in the Constitution. I mean, you know, you have a Senate race in some small state, and all the money comes from out of state.
Right.
And so the people in the state don't really end up having a say over who their senator is. It's a joke. So that would be my conclusion.
Eric Halterman, Kabuki Democracy, The System versus Barack Obama. Good read, as always. And thank you so much, Eric, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com.